Chapter 6, Closer. I want here to mention the personal. One of the reasons I came to love this pope is that I began my journey to serious Catholicism, to a deepened belief, during the time that he was the leader of the Catholic Church. And so I watched him more closely than I had any previous pope. I listened to him, learned from him. I took his observations as advice and his actions as inspiration. In time, I came to realize that I was experiencing him as a spiritual father. It took me years to understand that was how I saw him. We all want a spiritual father. We want someone who can inspire and guide us in the most important area of life, which is our very understanding of its meaning. So many of us did not have fathers who could teach us about faith and the deeper meaning of things, or who could teach us effectively or through demonstrating faith. For my parents, just existing, just keeping their heads above water, absorbed most of their energies. My father had not himself been taught what to believe and why to believe it and what is true and what should be honored. I came to see that John Paul was coming to play that role in my life. I am certain he did for millions, for tens of millions of others, too. A spiritual father is more than someone you admire. He is someone with whom you feel safe because he can point the way to truth, which somehow we all know is the only safe thing in the world. And so let me tell you my John Paul stories. I would see him on television and in magazines, gazing out at crowds, bowing his head in prayer, saying Mass, gesturing from a balcony in his weekly audience, waving at people as he passed through some city street in the Popemobile. And whenever I would see him, I would stop whatever I was doing without thinking and watch. Always I would be moved in some way I did not understand. Once, at the sight of him on TV, I began to weep, and then I sobbed and did not know why. And at these moments, when I was moved, I would always think of another picture, not of him, but of someone else. It was early in his papacy, on John Paul's first trip back to Poland. That country then was a rougher-looking place than it was before and is now. It was still in its own way pre-modern. When the Pope spoke at the famous Mass in the Blony Field, the land was trampled and large parts of it turned to mud. There was a picture of a woman that I saw in Life or Look magazine. She was there in the Blony Field. She was old, 70 or so, but old-fashioned old, with wiry gray hair. She was dressed in long, dark, nondescript clothes with some kind of a peasant scarf on her head. She looked like a European who had nothing. She was standing alone in the mud, but she was gazing up at the Pope, who was in the far distance, and she had a look on her face as if she was really seeing something. And I saw that picture. I did not keep it and have been thinking of it and looking for it for about 25 years. And I thought, I know who she is. She is someone I know. I thought without saying it to myself, she is me. Then, at that time in my life, as a young woman, I was in the mud and looking into some far distance. Somehow my heart and my head knew that what was big and beyond me was true, but I didn't act on the truth or include it in my life or allow it to direct me in any profound way. I lived a life of materialist mud, and I was not fully conscious of it. So many times, in so many ways over the past 25 years, I would go back and forth. I would follow the implications of my interior knowledge and embrace belief, and read great classics of religious thought, reach out to those who, it seemed to me, were more knowledgeable, more highly evolved. I would go to church and pay attention sometimes. I liked being there. And then I would step back and stop and become immersed again in the flat, stupid, and alluring world of no belief. The French, in another context, call this nostalgia for the mud. They mean a kind of bourgeois romanticization of impoverishment, which is to say they mean it to some degree in economic terms, but I mean it in spiritual terms. Every time I recognized the truth and lived it, I was happy. And when I did not, I was not. And yet I always returned to not happy, as if that were warm and happy mud. Once, as those days continued, but in a way reached their end, I talked with a man. He was a conservative intellectual, impressively bright, censorious by nature, who asked me over drinks if I believed in God. Yes, I said sturdily. He said, and in Christ? I said, yes. He said, really? Do you think if you died you'd go to heaven? I was surprised by this question, but I laughed and I said, yes, and he laughed. He said, why? And I don't recall what I said, but I remember what I thought. I thought, because I love God and mean well, and he knows. This struck me as news, that I loved God, for I don't think I'd been thinking of that a great deal. I was, as I say, not schooled in the church. Like many American Catholics of my generation, the baby boomers, I sort of slipped off the plate in terms of the inculcating of belief. So many of our parents were first and second and third generation immigrants from Europe who grew up in Brooklyn or Baltimore or Boston. Those old folks had been taught in a rigorous old-world school in which ethnicity seemed to have as much to do with who they were as faith. Many of them came to see the old Catholic ways as immigrant ways when what they wanted was America. Theirs was the age of FDR and Freud, All Quiet on the Western Front, the Great Depression. They went off to World War II, they experienced the Europe their parents had left, and they came back too cool for the room. My father had only one childhood religious memory that he shared. The day he showed up for his first communion, as a child of eight or so, a little Brooklyn street urchin with no father and a mother who neglected him, a priest or a brother, who were more numerous then, saw that my father had broken a rule. All the children had been told to wear white suits and white shoes. Well, my father had worn brown shoes, which were the only shoes he had. The priest or brother saw my father in line, saw the shoes, and hit him on the head with his fist. An ex-Catholic was born. My mother, too, associated Catholicism with unhappy things, though she was not so clear as to why. They married in 1947, my father just home from the war, and one belief they seemed to hold in common was that organized religion was more or less for the old-fashioned, for hypocrites, and for creeps who'd hit you on the head for wearing the wrong shoes. They wanted to be modern. They wanted to leave their not adequately lit apartments behind and enter the American sunlight. And while the church held little for them, other areas of life, which might even be called competing areas, seemed more alluring. My parents were born at roughly the same time as the American movie industry, in the mid-1920s, and during their most impressionable years in the 1930s and 1940s, when the world was most vividly imprinting itself on their young brains, the images they absorbed were not those of statues or religious art, but celluloid images, cinematic pictures. And I think my parents developed an imaginative reverence for the images they saw. Their icons were not the Blessed Virgin or the Infant of Padua, but Joan Blondell and Bogey and Gable and Cagney and Betty Davis. We did not, as a family, go to church, but we never missed the Academy Awards. All this made a big impression on me, but there is another counter-memory that made a bigger one. I had an old aunt, my maternal grandfather's sister, a girl from Donegal in Ireland who went to church every Sunday and who had religious cards and rosary beads in her bedroom. Her name was Jane Jane, and she visited us sometimes. I liked it when she was there. She brought order. She made dinner and cleaned the house and was happy to see us when we came home from school. Sometimes, as she walked along the street, what she was thinking about would escape her, and I would hear her praying aloud. She was eccentric, poetic, believed. I don't remember her teaching me about Jesus or the saints or God or heaven. I just remember her being, and my absorbing her being, her way of being alive. She really saved my life. In a chaotic household, roiling with unhappiness and illness, she would visit and bring calm. I could tell she had something, and I could tell it was good. So I started to think, when she took me to church, maybe nice people go here, or maybe if you go here, you become nice. In 1992, I met a man who inspired me and met him, as often happens in such stories, at a time that others were inspiring me too. I had joined a Christian Bible study group with some intelligent women, mostly Protestant, who were, to one degree or another, desperate to believe in something, but it had to be the truth. They'd already tried what wasn't true, and it hadn't worked. We had weekly meetings, and they were very important to me, in part because I learned so much about what was in the Bible I hadn't really known, and also because as people got to know one another in the group, they shared their lives and experiences, and I learned from that too. You would think, I suppose everyone thinks, and I thought as well, that Christians in Bible study would be mild ladies recounting their tidy little sins. Boy, was that not true. These were women who'd been through modern life. They had lived the 70s and 80s. They hadn't kept themselves apart and protected from the culture, but had jumped right in. And their conversation was as interesting as a modern novel. More so, actually, more interesting and richer and deeper, because they had experienced or were experiencing conversion, which had changed their lives, and now they had a context in which to frame their experiences. Their stories were wonderful. Drunken car accidents, domestic violence, infidelities, the reappearance after 20 years of an illegitimate child. It was better than television. Here's something that may surprise you. When one of those stories comes along where the New Jersey high school girl has a baby in the bathroom during the prom and then throws it in the trash so she can go back and keep dancing, when those stories come along, some people have a very good time condemning the high school girl. But my Bible study ladies never condemned the high school girl. They were the last to be surprised by sin or to feign surprise. There was also this that I noticed. My friends who were sophisticated non-believers, who were professionals and respected journalists, really wonderful people, they were often talking about others. There was a lot of gossip. Her children don't speak to her. He's gay. She married for the money. But the Bible study women were not talking about others. They were talking about themselves and their lives. They weren't judging others. They all knew, they had come to the conclusion along the way, that the lives they had previously lived were unwhole, not in accord with the peace that they somehow knew or intuited was out there and available and summoning. Some of them occasionally seemed swept by embarrassment. I find it hard to believe I did that, and that sort of thing. And some seemed to wrestle with guilt. But those who'd been Christian for a long time and lived their belief seemed beyond that, as if embarrassment at one's life was not only beside the point and boring and even rather vain, but was itself unwhole, not good, not of God. They thought it was of the evil one, as they say. Anyway, the general idea seemed to be, as Lucianne Goldberg once said of George Bush, quote, "What happened before Jesus stays with Jesus. He forgives everyone who seeks it. Who are you not to forgive yourself?" But I meant to be telling you about a man I met who inspired me. His name was Leonard Cheshire. I interviewed him for Mirabella magazine in 1990 when I was writing a column there. Cheshire was a great man, though not much known in America. He had been Group Captain Leonard Cheshire, a hero of World War II, and one of the most decorated airmen in the history of the Royal Air Force. I met him in Manhattan at the Madison Hotel for drinks. He was visiting America to promote an idea he had to turn old weapons of the Cold War into small metal symbols of peace. He was tall and slim and held himself in his dark suit with an erect bearing. His thinning gray hair was combed back straight. He was 73 years old, and our conversation turned, quickly, though I can't remember why, to religious faith. In a soft voice and with a striking humility, he told me of his life. In early July of 1945, his brother, Christopher, also an airman, who had been shot down in 1941 on the way back from a bombing run in Berlin, and who had been a prisoner of war held by the Nazis in Poland, was released, and Christopher returned to London. Leonard met him there and welcomed him home. They went for drinks to the Mayfair Hotel with a group of friends who were also veterans of the war. The evening was boisterous, but in time the conversation turned serious. They, the young, sophisticated, and well-educated men who'd just been through fighting a hellish war, as their fathers only 20 years before had been through fighting another hellish war, they found themselves arguing about God. They asserted, one after another, that God did not exist. Lord Cheshire told me, "I tried to change the conversation." And then he found himself saying this, quote, "You're talking nonsense. God is a person and you know it." And suddenly he knew it. He didn't know he knew that. He'd never thought about it. A week before, still in the service, he'd been briefed for the first time about the atomic bomb, which the Americans had just used on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. He told me, "I was coming to terms with the realization that God really does exist, and what am I going to do with that information, and coming to terms with the nuclear age." He was thinking to himself, he told me, "I'm one of the lucky ones. There were those who didn't make it. I couldn't just settle for a nicely paid job or staying on in the Air Force." He wanted to make the world better. He joined the Church of England, but he thought it did not have the answers he was looking for. He continued to look for a spiritual home, and then a few years after the war ended, an epical event that didn't look big at the time, but only frustrating, occurred. A friend of his was desperately ill and needed somewhere to stay. There was no place that could or would take him, and so Cheshire decided to take him to his home in Hampshire in England and to care for him there. This was the beginning of what became Cheshire's lifelong mission, to help the disabled live in dignity in what, in time, came to be known as Cheshire Homes and Cheshire Houses, of which there are now hundreds throughout the world. After a lifetime of working with the sick and disabled, he came to believe, as he later said, that their suffering was not pointless and not at all without meaning. He came to believe that the suffering had a mission, and that is, quote, "to draw out the inherent goodwill that is in all of us, and so to make us forget ourselves and draw closer to one another in our common journey through life," unquote. I would often think of those words in the early years of the 21st century as I watched old John Paul. Cheshire was famous as a good man, though he did not see it that way. He saw himself simply as part of something, a small piece of a larger fact. And when I met him in 1992, he told me what he had learned in his life. He said, "I now know that God has a plan for each of us. The thing is to find out what it is." "How?" I asked him. "Through prayer," he said, "through keeping your mind open, through the circumstances of daily life and the people you meet." As I took all this in, he said, "I further know that if God has something special for you, you have a knowledge of it inside you, which causes you not to be satisfied with anything that isn't this thing. You're restless," he said, "until you find it." I want to bring John Paul back into this, for he was ever in the background to my thoughts and experiences in those days when I was coming to regard him as a spiritual father. I see now new meaning in the first two times I ever set my eyes on him in person. The first time he was far away from me, and I could barely see him. The second time he was closer, I could have touched him. These two facts, far away and closer, seemed to me to have an underlying meaning. The first time I set eyes on John Paul was on his first trip to America in 1979 when he was a new pope. I was at that time a young writer and producer on the radio side of CBS News, and I was lucky to be assigned to be one of the producers for the live network radio coverage of the pope's appearance at St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York. I got all dressed up in what I felt was a brilliantly attractive suit, but I was not doing it for the event or the church or the Pope. I had other things on my mind, a lovely man, and I was on my way to no good. I promise you, I did not care. I only cared that it was very glamorous to be all dressed up on a major assignment and in St. Patrick's, which was full of attractive and important people. The mayor, the governor, the local anchorman. So I got to St. Patrick's. I was wearing around my neck an aluminum chain from which dangled the media credentials that important media folk like myself wore in order to get past the regular people waiting in line. I was respectfully waved in at a series of checkpoints. It was clear I was a very important person. By the way, I looked excellent in my dark red silk blouse and my shimmering charcoal gray suit, which was accessorized by my plastic ID tags with CBS News written all over them. I got to the place where I was supposed to do my work, with the technicians and some reporters in the back of the cathedral. Our lines were up and working, the technicians had done their jobs well, the reporters were waiting to report on the entrance of the Pope. There was nothing really for me to do except stand around looking official and rather glamorous in my black high heels. I got bored, I wanted to see more, and I thought it would be nice if more people could see how good I looked. So I walked away from our work area. I walked out a big side door of the cathedral and stood on the great marble standing area, beyond which are the great marble steps on the side of the cathedral. I stood there looking out at everyone, the people with no tickets, with no credentials, with no IDs, with a Network News logo on them. I stood there looking at them with my arms folded, important insider that I was. "Move on." It was a police officer in a sharp black hat. He was middle-aged and stern-looking, and he was talking to me. "Hello, officer," I said. I was cool. He must be confused. "I have ID. I'm with CBS News." He looked at me and said, "I don't care. Move on. Outside." I was totally startled. He did not seem to know that I was an important person. He did not seem to care. No, it was more than that. I had the distinct and immediate feeling he didn't like my type. And then I got that bad feeling you get when information that is true suddenly breaks through to you. And I thought, and then quickly ejected from my mind, I thought these words, "I am a type." And I wouldn't like my type either. So he shooed me from the steps. I joined the crowd outside and waited in line and got past the checkpoints and got past the guards and ran in late to be with my colleagues, none of whom were amused at my lateness. The Pope came, we reported it, and I went on with my life. But I was in a somewhat dark time, though I did not know it, and I couldn't help feel in the days and years afterwards that I got shooed from the cathedral because I didn't deserve to be there. And I still think that's true. And years later, as I actually became serious about life and what is expected of us and what is true and important, I'd think, I was being told that day what a mess I was. I didn't listen, but I did hear.